From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Tibetan Buddhist Lama Khensay Norbu tells us about directing his first feature film, The Cop. It's about Tibetan monks who are soccer fans. The film stars real monks and was shot in their monastery. Norbu was discovered at the age of 7 to be the reincarnation of a Buddhist master and didn't see a movie until he was 18. We'll talk with him about how he reconciles his movie making with his Buddhist philosophy. And TV critic David Bianculli previews Mary and Rhoda, the TV movie reuniting Mary Tyler Moore and Valerie Harper. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton sent Congress a $1.8 trillion budget today, promising it would expand health care, reduce the national debt, and cut taxes. And the president's proposal would spend more on education and the environment and cut taxes for people who are ill, the poor, and the elderly. He said it would eliminate the $3.7 trillion publicly held portion of the national debt by 2013. Republicans greeted the budget with ridicule. House Budget Chairman John Kasich called it the president's fantasy, saying it's loaded with items Democrats feel they'll need to get Vice President Al Gore elected president. Republican presidential hopeful George W. Bush says he plans to do a better job defending his record following his defeat by rival John McCain in the New Hampshire primary. Bush is campaigning in Delaware in advance of tomorrow's Republican primary. NPR's Anthony Brooks reports.
After his drubbing in New Hampshire and a weekend off in Texas, George W. Bush is back on the campaign trail with a retooled campaign and the new motto, A Reformer with Results. And he's being more aggressive, labeling John McCain a Washington insider who may talk the talk of reform, but who has yet to walk the walk.
On the one hand, he preaches campaign funding reform. On the other hand, he says pass the plate. And we're going to have that discussion, the difference between what people say and what people do in politics. That's the Washington game.
Bush is counting on a win in Delaware tomorrow. Steve Forbes won it 4 years ago and is campaigning here again. But McCain is concentrating on South Carolina and Michigan, from where he said today, I understand Governor Bush is now a reformer. If so, it's his first day on the job. I've been at it 17 years. Anthony Brooks, NPR News, Dover, Delaware.
In Northern Ireland today, a small group calling itself the Continuity IRA says it carried out the bombing at a rural hotel. The splinter group warned of further violence. Marianne McGuire reports from Belfast.
In a statement, the Continuity IRA warned it would continue what it described as its war effort until Britain agrees to withdraw from Northern Ireland. The small dissident organization is opposed to the peace accord. It is also the only Irish Republican group not observing a ceasefire. The attack has heightened tensions at a time the peace process is in deep crisis. The 10-week-old power-sharing government could be suspended on Thursday. Meanwhile, pro-British Ulster unionists have been meeting to discuss the proposals aimed at making the Royal Ulster Constabulary acceptable to all communities. A dissident unionist said the reforms were a sop to the Irish Sinn Féin Party. Willie Thompson said that members of his party had less confidence than ever in the peace accord. For NPR News, I'm Marianne McGuire in Belfast.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 58 points to close at 10,905 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. Golfer Tiger Woods won his sixth Professional Golfers Association tournament in a row today by taking the Pebble Beach National Pro-Am in California. Woods is the first player since 1948 to do it when Ben Hogan accomplished the feat. He's closer to Byron Nelson's 1945 record of 11 victories in a row. After the death of four Israeli soldiers in South Lebanon in the past week, Israel has launched a retaliatory raid against Lebanese infrastructure. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports.
Much of Beirut is now in darkness after Israeli warplanes struck a power station outside the capital. Air-to-surface missiles also hit a power station in the northern town of Tripoli and a headquarters of the Hezbollah guerrillas in the town of Baalbek, famous for its Roman ruins. The raids are Israel's heaviest on Lebanon since last June. Hezbollah had stepped up its attacks against Israeli occupation since Israeli-Syrian peace talks stalled last month. Syria is the power broker in Lebanon, and today's retaliation follows repeated warnings to Syria to rein in Hezbollah. The mounting violence has provoked calls for an immediate Israeli withdrawal from Lebanon, where it's been embroiled in a war of attrition for two decades. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Jerusalem.
A spokesman for Senator Edward Kennedy says the Massachusetts Democrat is suffering from a flu-like illness and will remain in a Washington hospital for the next several days. Kennedy, who's 67, was admitted to the hospital yesterday, where he's being treated for a cough, muscle aches, chills, and a fever. In stocks today, the NASDAQ Composite Index gained 76 points to close at a record 4,320. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Kensei Norbu, is a high Tibetan Buddhist lama, or monk, who has done something very unusual for a lama. He's written and directed his first feature film, The Cup. It's also the first feature ever made in his country, Bhutan, which is in the Himalayas near Tibet. The Cup was filmed at a real monastery in a Tibetan refugee settlement in the foothills of the Himalayas. The movie is about two young men who escape from Chinese-ruled Tibet and flee to a Tibetan monastery in exile. Their biggest surprise at the monastery is that most of the monks love soccer. A couple are obsessed with it and are willing to go to extremes to bring a TV to the monastery so they can watch the World Cup. Kensei Norbu is a spiritual director of two meditation centers in Bhutan and Sikkim and two Buddhist colleges in India and Bhutan. His movie, The Cup, has already opened in New York and Los Angeles and opens in other cities this Friday. I asked him if many Tibetan monks are soccer fans.
Yes, there are a lot of young monks who are soccer fans. I had several ideas that I could have filmed, but many of these ideas would have cost me much more money. So I chose this particular story because it was financially most feasible. And also I was told that when a first-time director makes a film, one must do something that you are confident with. And I'm very confident with this story because I know the people there, I know the location, and I also, somehow it's like a autobiographical for me. So I'm very confident with the story.
I think a lot of our listeners will wonder, how do monks reconcile the competitive nature of sports, the emphasis on winning, with the Buddhist renunciation of ego?
Mm-hmm. Well, here I need to explain a little bit more. I think people generally tend to misunderstand between two things, that is Buddhism and Buddhist. Buddhism, of course, talk about, you know, egolessness, going beyond pride, going beyond competitiveness and all that. But Buddhists are normal human beings. So when Buddhists not behaving well, like I don't behave well, it's not necessarily Buddhism's fault. And that's something very important to know.
So are there any Buddhists in the temple who are opposed to the monks being soccer fans?
There are maybe some more conservative, more traditional, older generations who might have a second thought on watching soccer or even like making film. But that's because, for instance, for many of these older generations, film is always something to do with the sex and violence. And I don't blame them for them to think that way, because that's the only kind of film that they get to watch. If only they see films by people like Andrei Tarkovsky, for instance. And they are so spiritual. And through that, you can learn a lot.
Is there a TV or a VCR in the monastery where you live?
Yes. The monastery that I filmed this film had technologically not so good VCR. The VCR, all this modern technology, is not a threat to Buddhism. The threat to Buddhist and Buddhism is the ego, our pride, our negative emotions. In fact, it's important for us to realize that these mediums can be used for our own benefit.
For teaching other people about Buddhism or about Tibet or just for as an art form.
Mm-hmm. And it's not like Buddhism doesn't have this habit of using image to express Buddhist wisdom and compassion.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for 2,500 years, there's an example of using image, such as paintings, sculpture, so many of them. And for me, film is just a modern-day painting. It's a modern-day sculpturing.
Now, you run several Buddhist schools, and do you live in one of the monasteries?
No, I have. Actually, I was trained by a tutor, and I have never actually lived in a monastery. But when I was about mid-20, I decided to establish some school for younger generations.
So these aren't people who are necessarily going to become monks?
Most of them are monks, but they don't necessarily have to be a monk for whole life.
Mm-hmm. So you're a monk, but you don't live in a monastery?
Well, again, here, the concept of monk, what do you mean by monk? I think there is a Western concept of monk, and then there is, I think, the word monk... Mm-hmm. is kind of confusing here.
Right.
For instance, like in Japan, there's a big phenomena of Buddhism, and there's so-called Zen monks. Maybe that's kind of familiar in the West, Zen monks, you know, Zen Buddhism. And Zen monks have their family, you know, they have children, they have household. So the monks, when you talk about the monks, if you are talking more on from the Christian point of view, maybe you are talking about celibates. Is that what you are talking about here?
No, I just mean someone whose life centers around spiritual contemplation and mm-hmm. religious thought and religious training and so on.
Well, in this case, yes, I am trying to be someone... I'm trying to sort of concentrate my life on the spiritual things mm-hmm. and like that. But it doesn't mean that I may not get married and things like that. I might get married. I might have a household. I don't know.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Kensei Norbu. He's a Tibetan Lama who lives in the country of Bhutan. And he just made his first feature film. It's called The Cup. Have you seen movies all your life?
No, the film, moving picture was introduced to me quite late. I mean, when I was young, I stayed in a very remote place. The only television that I have seen when I was young, in my late, I think my teenage time, was in a train station in India while I was waiting for a train. There was this monitor that broadcasts all this train schedule, I guess, but because the train is so late, sometimes they show these Indian film, and those were my first visual sort of moving picture experience.
How old were you?
I think I was like 18 at that time.
Wow. And what about the first time you were in a movie theater?
Maybe around 20. In India.
Do you remember what the movie was?
I think it was an Indian film. I don't remember the name.
Right,
But the first Western film I remember, I think, I've been thinking about it. It was James Bond, Man with a Golden Gun.
Oh, that's great. That must have been like such a different world Because, I mean, it's a world that doesn't really exist in the first place. But
I remember one experience in the Man with the Golden Gun, when these beautiful girls with bikini, when I see this, I felt very sort of myself, very embarrassed. Sort of, I was looking right and left. I don't know, feeling embarrassed.
Because of the sexuality?
Because, you know, until then I have never been sort of confronted with a big picture of a,
of a nearly naked woman.
Yes.
In a public setting, no doubt.
No less. But still, you know, you feel that.
So, but early on, movies must have gotten to you since you became a filmmaker. Did the James Bond movie excite you, or was it not till later that that you fell in love with movies?
No, those days I watched film purely for entertainment. The idea of making the film never occurred in my head. I mean, of course not. Most of the films that I watch, the Hollywood films, they had car crash and aeroplane and all that. I mean, we were quite poor. We had no car to ride, let alone to crash. It was much later when I went to London. I went to National Film Theatre, and it is there that I began to see films actually made in India by Indian, Satyajit Ray, and some other like Ozu and Andrei Tarkovsky. It is because of their film that I had this inspiration or wish to make the film.
You worked with Bernardo Bertolucci on his film Little Buddha. How did you get to work with him on it?
Well, as I was saying, when I was in London, I was supposed to be studying, actually, to finish my master's degree. And also, I was teaching in a Buddhist center, Buddhist philosophy. And Bernardo somehow heard that there is a Tibetan Lama who is so crazy about film. And it was, at that time, he was just beginning to develop the story of Little Buddha. And he wanted someone to work with him, just to as a consultant. And he was searching for me, and then I was, of course, very much interested in filmmaking. And all my friends say, if you want to make film, this is the best chance. So I approached him, and then I became sort of his consultant. I got the chance to sit next to him when he was shooting later on, and that's how I met him.
My guest is Tibetan Buddhist Lama Kensei Norbu. He wrote and directed the new film, The Cup. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tibetan Buddhist Lama Kensei Norbu. He's written and directed his first feature film, The Cup, about Tibetan monks who love soccer. Now, I believe there's virtually no movie industry in Bhutan. I mean, I think yours is the first film to actually come out of the country.
Yes.
Are there movie theaters there?
Yes. There's three in the country.
And what do they show?
Most of the time, Hindi films. Uh-huh. Indian film. With a lot of dances and songs and love affairs and all that.
So, in the position of making the first feature film to come out of your country, what did you have to do just to get equipment to make the movie?
Oh, this was difficult. Initially, when I had this idea of making the film, I heard that I don't remember the director's name, but El Mariachi was made.
Roberto Rodriguez.
Yes. El Mariachi was done under $10,000. So I thought, well, maybe I can actually make a film. Because the story, the present story, The Cup, is quite, I mean, can be made, I thought, because actors I don't have to pay, the monastery I know. And but then I realized that's not possible. I mean, the nearest place to rent a cheapest 16mm camera happened to be Australia. And like buying film stocks, all of that. So we estimated sort of $80,000. And I don't know, I tried to put mortgage of some of my belongings. And even then, it was still not possible. So I sort of postponed my idea of making the film. And then again, I had the opportunity to visit London, and I met Jeremy Thomas, who produced Little Buddha, and I knew him by then. And I showed him my script, and he read the script for several days, and he called me, and he said, there's someone in New York who is willing to finance my film.
And so once your film was financed, what did you do for equipment? Did you rent it from Australia?
Yes. And I asked, see, I go around some of the Western countries and I teach Buddhism, and some of them have become kind of long-term student. And among them, there are some photographers and movie-related people, and I asked them to volunteer, so they did it.
So they helped you shoot it? And
yes.
Helped you get the equipment?
Yes.
Now, most of the monks in your film are the actual monks from the monastery.
Yes.
Near you. And you explained one of the reasons why you cast them, or the main reason why you cast them, was this way you wouldn't have to pay them. They were very good in the movie. Were they receptive to the idea? Did they want to be in a feature film?
It's not so much about what how much they want to be in the feature film or not. This is actually quite important that I explain. You know, places like London or New York, if you make, many young people are into have this enthusiasm to make film. So if you are making film, everybody, many people want to be part of it. But part, in that part of the world where I live, filmmaking is not a big deal. So if it happens, okay. If it doesn't happen, then it's also okay. You know, that kind of attitude they have.
Mm-hmm.
So for a filmmaker, it's kind of frustrating. But I guess as a Buddhist, maybe this is good. Maybe this kind of, you know, attitude is good. So I explained to the head of the monastery, who is a very close friend of mine, saying that I want to do this film. And the reason why I wanted to do this actually is probably it may never happen, but I want to eventually make a film based on the life of the Buddha. And to do that, I need to have a little bit of portfolio, so to speak. And I'm doing this, and it also contains a little bit of, about Tibetan and monastic life. And he said, yeah, that's a good idea. Let's do it. And since he and both myself are considered as kind of a higher-ranking I don't know, teachers in those this region, I guess we sort of used our tyranny a little bit, saying, okay, we decided to make a film. Okay, everybody has to join. So next morning, everybody's there without any, you know, feeling of bad feeling or also not too much enthusiasm.
How familiar were the monks with the concept of acting?
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, the story is written in English because that's the only way I can get to show the producers in the West. So, and also, we have in the Tibetan tradition, we don't have this tradition of writing script. Like, I actually tried once, like kitchen, interior, night. I just can't put that in Tibetan. It doesn't make any sense. So I decided to write in English. So that means my actors, they don't know the story at all. It was such a rush, I didn't have a chance to tell them the story before we began shooting. And while we shoot, because of the weather and, of course, because of just the normal thing, you know, you don't shoot with sequence, right? I shot off sequence. So monks, they didn't know the complete story. They sort of vaguely know that this is about soccer. That's all.
When you were shooting the cop, did you have to do anything to make sure that you weren't being intrusive on other people's spiritual practices?
Yes, of course. I respected their practice, like daily meditation and all that. Of course, it has to be shifted up. You know, like monks had to get up. Usually they get up like 5, but then during the shooting, they get up like 3 in the morning so that they do their daily prayers and meditations. They finish around 4:30 and then they had a short, 5 they finish, and then they have a breakfast, and then 6 o'clock we shoot. So in this way, you can say I have disturbed their sort of routine, daily routine. But other than that, no, I didn't. I think this is what I think, but who knows, you know. I think and I hope I didn't disturb them.
Did you show the monks footage of the film as it was being shot?
We never get to see the rushes. It has to be sent to Australia to process. And I had to wait like 10 days before someone there called me and say okay or not. And sometimes the telephone line doesn't work, and there was so much paranoia. I actually now realize, if not for all this Buddhist training of meditation and all that, I would have gone crazy by now.
What was the reaction when the monks finally did see the film, assuming they have seen it?
Not many of them seen it yet, because I still couldn't arrange a videotape. Some of them seen it, and now they're happy because it at last makes sense. When I was shooting, for instance, the abbot always complains to me, saying, why you put the camera behind my ear? You know, I was trying to get a point of view. And they could never understand because, they know what photography is, but usually the camera is always in front of them.
Kensei Norbu wrote and directed the new film, The Cup. It's already opened in New York and Los Angeles and opens in more cities this Friday. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Sisiv, building custom e-business systems for global 2,000 companies worldwide. On the web at CYSIVE.com. And from Random House and Bantam Books Division, publisher of Barbara Jordan, American Hero, by Mary Beth Rogers, available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, how to make a movie without your ego getting out of control. We continue our conversation with Kensei Norbu, a Tibetan Buddhist Lama who has just directed his first feature film. And David Bianculli reviews Mary and Rhoda, the made-for-TV movie that reunites Mary Tyler Moore and Valerie Harper. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Tibetan monk Khensei Norbu. He's written and directed his first feature film, The Cup. It's also the first feature produced in his country, Bhutan, which is located in the Himalayas near Tibet. The Cup was shot in a real Tibetan Buddhist monastery in exile in the Himalayas. The monks who live there portray the monks in the movie. There's a character in the movie who's a very eccentric fortune teller who never bathes and he smells mm-hmm. really bad. Mm-hmm. But even the people from the monastery go to him mm-hmm. to have him predict what the outcome of things will be.
Yes.
Who is the person who you cast as the fortune teller?
He is a real sort of saint. He's a real fortune teller, but he predicts things. He's respected in the community as a great saint. And he is actually just like how he is portrayed in the film, if not more. He's always disappeared somewhere, and we almost know where he is. Usually he's in the bar or in a dice room gambling.
You know, a lot of people might think, well, if he's so sacred, why doesn't he bathe?
This is what I think a lot of people have to know. By being saint does not necessarily mean that you have to be a slave of a society. You know, in Buddhism, we talk about elegance, union of elegance and outrageousness. To be elegant is important because that way you inspire people. But when you are too caught up with elegance, then you become a slave of a society. Then you are nothing. You are just you lose your genuineness. So I think this man practices in a very sort of normal term, crazy wisdom.
Do you ever go to him to predict the outcome of things?
I did several times. I asked him, I think, which film stock should I use, Fujifilm or Kodak?
Now, what does he know about that?
Well, he doesn't know anything. I just tell him, okay, just tell me the green box or the yellow box, like that.
And how does he decide?
Then he does the prediction, and then he says this, pointing to the Fuji.
And did you use the Fuji after that?
Yes.
Were you happy with the outcome?
Yes. These are mostly because, you see, I haven't been... technical things I don't know so much. See, I like to make film. This has been my ambition. But I haven't been to a proper film school. I don't know the photography stuff. So there's always... When I actually begin to shoot this film, there's all these technical questions like, what film stocks should I use? And then when I ask my friends, they give me all kinds of answers, which takes a long time. So my sort of method was to save the time, just ask these guys.
That sounds great. My guest is Khensei Norbu, and he is a Tibetan Lama who has made not only his first feature film, but it's the first feature film to be made in his country of Bhutan, which is near Tibet. The movie is called The Cup. At the age of 7, you were discovered to be the reincarnation of a Buddhist saint. Mm-hmm. Who were you discovered to be the reincarnation of?
Oh, he was a great master. He was very famous for emphasizing the non-sectarian or ecumenical attitude with all the different schools and different methods of Buddhism. And he was also he worked very hard preserving a lot of, in Buddhism, and especially in Tibetan Buddhism, we really emphasize so much on keeping the lineage. When the lineage gets very, very thin, then we try to really preserve it. And he's very well known for that.
So what sense did this make to you when you were 7? I mean, how were you told? Let's get to first, how were you discovered? Who mm-hmm. is it that came and decided that you were the reincarnation?
When I really didn't know so much. And later on, I didn't ask this question to the people. Okay, anyway, I was in a school. I was 7 and I was in a Jesuit school, actually, a Christian school. Just beginning to study, because that's what my parents decided. And after a few months, one day, there was a man sent by my family, and this man said, "You have to go. There's no time for school now." So I went, and there was all my parents waiting, and in our family, there's a new guest, a Tibetan, whom I have never seen before. And as soon as he saw me, he gave me a long scarf and he said, "I am your student." And that's all. And I didn't think about it so much. But later then I realized that these are the people who has been doing research on whereabouts of the reincarnate Lama or the boy.
It must be very strange to be 7 and have an adult say to you, "I am your student."
Yes. But since it's kind of, this is a phenomenon that happens in that part of the world, again, it's not too strange. Mm-hmm, not too strange. Then I was taken away from my parents. And I went to Sikkim in India, and I was given all the training. And now sometimes when I think about the life and the works of this great master who's supposed to be my past incarnation, I have a doubt, because the things that I do, my behavior, my way of thinking is not that saintly all the time. But again, if Tibetan people think that I am this man, and if this benefits a certain society, then I guess I have to pretend I am. And I do not have any conflict.
How did they decide that you were the reincarnation of this 19th century saint?
This happens quite a lot within the Tibetan society. And each time it's slightly different. But for me, I think it was mainly the Lama who actually discovered me had dreams of the sign of, the Tibetan have, Chinese, we believe in the animal zodiac sign for each person. And he sort of predicted the age, the name, and the sign of the birth of my father, mother, and how many children this family has, and it's the second child of this family. And also he had described the color of the house of the family, all of that. So this is how they found.
What do you think your parents' reaction was? Do you think that your parents were honored that you were discovered as the reincarnation of a saint, or do you think that they were heartbroken that you were going to be taken away from them and trained someplace else?
I think mixed feelings. Although my family, my father is himself quite well-known because his father, my grandfather, is actually very, very respected master and a poet in the Tibetan society. So this thing is kind of, my family is very strongly connected to Tibetan Buddhism. So this is kind of normal to them. But at the same time, my grandmother and my mother, of course, had a little bit of a hard time. But, of course, they understand that this is the best for their child.
My guest is Tibetan Buddhist Lama Khensei Norbu. He wrote and directed the new film, The Cup. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. ¶¶ you're just joining us, my guest is Kensei Norbu. He's a Tibetan Lama who lives in the country of Bhutan, which is near Tibet. And he's made his first feature film, which is also the first feature film to ever be made in his country. It's called The Cup. You know, in the West, issues like personal identity and self-esteem are very important. I know I once interviewed Geshe Thupten, who is a translator for the Dalai Lama, and he said that the Dalai Lama was once asked about self-esteem at a psychiatry conference he was attending, mm-hmm. and he found the concept of self-esteem just incomprehensible to him. But mm-hmm. I'm wondering how being discovered as the reincarnation of a saint affects your concept of personal identity, of who you are, of self-esteem, or if that all that stuff is like too foreign to even think about.
I have heard about this concept of self-esteem and all that, and I have even actually read some books and talked about it with my friends. This is something that I think he's right. It's kind of difficult for me to comprehend. Many times I feel that so-called self-esteem that West talks about is actually a word, it's a disguise to protect this insecurity that we have. Now, to answer your question, I try not to have the ego, the pride of having, pride of being that, being the reincarnation of this great master, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, as I was saying earlier, I actually sometimes doubt that I am.
Would it be considered rude to confess those doubts to a Tibetan who believed that you were the reincarnation? Would it be, in a way, challenging them to confess your doubt?
Ah, that's an interesting question. I did actually confess that. And you know what my master would say? Oh, good. This is good practice for you. This is a humility.
Interesting.
You know, humbleness. Humbleness. Being humbled is so important.
Mm-hmm. So, but do you think other people would interpret it as humility or as not sufficiently believing in the faith?
This is a little complicated, isn't it? Okay, it's other people's duty to think that I am reincarnation of this great master, right? But for me, it's my duty to not to have this pride of being the reincarnation of this great master. So what would my master say? He said, to benefit others, you must visualize and you must think that you are the reincarnation of this great master. For yourself, you must think that you are someone who has all these negative things such as pride, jealousy, anger, and so on.
That's really interesting. Now, what about free will? Does it influence the amount of free will you feel you're allowed to have
mm-hmm.
when you're identified as the reincarnation of a 19th century saint? Even when it comes down to like your free will to decide you want to make a movie.
What is your main question here?
If being a reincarnation of a saint affects your free will, your ability to do what you want to do, to pursue your heart in terms of, say, your artistic desire.
Oh, no, it doesn't at all. You know, it has no barrier or it has no, some kind of, okay, now that you are reincarnation of such and such, you are not allowed to do such and such. There is no restrictions like that. Because then we are talking about the philosophy. See, I'm recognized as a reincarnation of such and such master, and this master is a Buddhist, okay? Now, whether I want to be a Buddhist or not, I have my own free will. And if I decided to become a Buddhist, then in Buddhism, the most important thing is to understand the view of interdependent and the practice of compassion. And practice of compassion, you can apply any kind of method. You can become a politician if you want to. You can be a, I don't know, prostitute if you want to. You can be a filmmaker if you want to. So there's no restrictions like that.
And you never have to say to yourself, what would he have done if he were in my shoes? What would the 19th century saint have done in response to this dilemma I face today?
Actually, I thought about that. And because, you know, sometimes my master would joking, half jokingly and half sarcastically, when I don't do well in my studies, they would say, you know, you are supposed to be incarnation of such and such master. Why you are not doing well? Okay? And later, I began to think, well, it is a different time. And if he came now, he has to do things according to present day. He would use phone, he would use fax, he would use internet, probably much faster than me, because like now, I don't know how to even switch on a computer still.
Do you have to decide now how much you want to be in the world and how much you want to be kind of removed from the world in a more secluded, meditative environment?
Yes. That's what exactly what I'm thinking of doing. Like after June or July this year, I'm hoping to do about a year or maybe 2 years retreat. I really need it. Otherwise, I may be caught with this trap of ego and publicity and all of that, and I have to watch that out. I mean, in Buddhism, we talk about strength, right? To be strong spiritually, whatever, mentally. And Buddha said, a person can become weak when a person falls into 8 different traps. I will not go telling all the 8 traps, but he said, okay, if you want to be praised, that is one trap that you become weak. If you don't want to be criticized, that is a second trap makes human being weak. So there's 8 of these. And when you go to film festivals and when you are exposed to this kind of world, I almost find it just the opposite. Like, okay, I have made a film. And of course, people, your film should be praised. Otherwise, there's no market. Your film shouldn't be criticized by critics. Otherwise, there's no market. So it's just the opposite, you know? But having said that, Buddha said, if you are walking over a trap, and if you know that this is a trap, then you walk over this, okay? You are walking over the trap and knowing that this is a trap. Then he said, this is a joy, this is a humorous. So what I'm trying to tell you is, I need to learn that these are trap, and I should have the courage to walk over it. And this is what I need to learn. And to do that, I need to do practice.
Have you been to Hollywood?
Los Angeles, yes. And yeah, I guess that's Hollywood, isn't it? Somewhere there.
I mean, it's not that I work there, but, you know, from afar, it certainly looks like it would be like an ego festival there.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what's it like to watch, like, so many people with so much at stake financially and in terms of their own ego?
Yes, I have. Yeah, I came back from Los Angeles, and one night I actually have to confess that I went to strip joint?
Yes.
Club?
Yes. Yeah.
And I saw a lot of girls with breast that's, put a silicone or something.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, that's so sad, because your ego is so insecure, and if one make like that, you know, Los Angeles, I found that, and you are right, it's a festival of ego, and I don't know whether we should call it a festival, because ego is usually, the nature of the ego is the insecurity. That's why you have to put in silicone. That's why you have to, I don't know, do things that you don't have to do.
Can I ask why you went to the strip club?
Oh, just, you know, as a normal human being. I wanted to go to see. Well, no profound reason here.
What did you think of the atmosphere?
Good, actually. It was like a monastery. Because, you know, you are not allowed to drink alcohol. You are not supposed to smoke. And you are not supposed to touch the girls. That's what they said. And you just watch. So that's a very challenging, I thought.
Well, I thank you so much for talking with us. I've really enjoyed speaking with you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And good luck with the movie.
Thank you.
Kensei Norbu wrote and directed the new film, The Cup. It's already opened in New York and Los Angeles and opens in more cities this Friday. Coming up, David Bianculli reviews the new made-for-TV movie, Mary and Rhoda. This is Fresh Air. Tonight on ABC, Mary Tyler Moore returns to her classic character of Mary Richards from The Mary Tyler Moore Show and brings with her Valerie Harper, who played her best friend Rhoda Morgenstern. This telemovie reunion is called Mary and Rhoda. TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
The Mary and Rhoda telemovie opens very cleverly. We see Mary Richards, older but no less bubbly, walking down the city sidewalk as her old familiar theme song plays underneath. But this is the busier city. It's New York, not Minneapolis. And things have changed a lot since the 70s. So as Mary walks the crowded streets, a stranger bumps into her and rams her off course. Just the sort of thing that happens all the time to Ally McBeal. And Mary's theme song changes to a modern version, played and growled by Joan Jett.
How will you make it on your own? This world is...
You can turn the world on with a smile. You can take a nothing day and suddenly make it all seem worthwhile. What if you girl and you should know it?
The message is that the times they have changed. And this telemovie, which is what remains of an abandoned series idea starring Moore and Harper, tries to catch us up with the lives of these two familiar characters. The musical joke is a great start, but Mary and Rhoda loses steam quickly. The problem is the movie tries a little too hard. It's done as a comedy-drama telemovie without a laugh track, which is a tricky mix, but not impossible. TV viewers are used to this form now, thanks to the likes of Twin Peaks, Northern Exposure, and even Ally McBeal. And actually, the granddaddy of TV comedy dramas, the show that pioneered the form, was Lou Grant, in which Ed Asner took his character from The Mary Tyler Moore Show and made a successful transition from sitcom to what was then called dramedy. Lou and the rest of the gang are nowhere to be found in this Mary and Rhoda telemovie. Instead, we get 20 clunky minutes of exposition, learning that Mary was happily married and, like Rhoda, has a grown daughter. We also learn that Mary's husband recently died and left her in enough debt to have to re-enter the workplace at age 60. When she does, she's right where she started, or right where the Mary Tyler Moore Show started 30 years ago, with Mary Richards undergoing a very uncomfortable job interview with a TV executive. Last time, it was Asner as Lou Grant telling Mary, "You've got spunk," then adding, "I hate spunk." This time, it's Elon Gold as Jonah, a young TV executive with an ultra-modern office and an ultra-rude attitude.
Well, let's see. Got an impressive resume.
I'm 60.
And I'm 33. Now that we've got that out of the way.
Well, it's just that that's the next question after I'm told I have an impressive resume, so.
You know, Mary, I founded this station because I didn't think people were seeing themselves reflected on TV. So I started with reality programming, Final Regrets. Have you seen that?
Which one is that?
Well, that's where we had people who were about to die talk about what they didn't do or fight with family members, you know, that sort of thing. Have you seen it?
No. Well, I don't watch enough TV.
So tell me about you.
I started as an associate producer of the news at station WJM in Minneapolis.
Oh, Barbara, never pick up Porsche. Tell John to move lunch to Wednesday. Skip to the middle.
Well, then I moved to New York and got my master's in journalism.
Mike, I pressed cappuccino and it didn't light up. You want anything?
No. That scene is one intentional nod to the old series. Others include the giant gold M still hanging on Mary's wall, and the fact that she still throws lousy dinner parties. Yet even though the references are cute, the show's concept is sound, and even the casting choices and performances are very good, Mary and Rhoda ends up being derailed by its script. When Asner went from the Mary Tyler Moore Show to Lou Grant, he took with him some of TV's very best writers and producers. Mary Tyler Moore, one of the executive producers of this telemovie, didn't insist on the same level of comedy experience, and it shows. The telemovie by writer Katie Ford and director Barney Kelman strains too hard for both sentimentality and laughs and ends up being a disappointment. Let's not be too hard, though, on Mary Tyler Moore. With Laura Petrie from The Dick Van Dyke Show and Mary Richards in her own series, she's already delivered two of the most charming, funny, memorable, and significant characters in the history of American television. That's an act that even she can be forgiven for finding difficult to follow, much less to repeat.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, and Patty Leswing. Research assistance from Brendan Noonan. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from the Industry Standard and thestandard.com, providing today's business executive with intelligence on the internet economy, on the web at www.thestandard.com, and from Reel.com, an online source for movies offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD, on the web at reel.com. AOL keyword REEL. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, using forensic science to identify the remains of the disappeared, bodies buried in mass graves, and other victims of government-sponsored murder. We talk with Mercedes Doretti, co-founder of the Argentine Forensic Anthropology Team. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.